This is Software Engineering Radio, the podcast for professional developers on the web at se-radio.net. SE Radio is brought to you by the IEEE Computer Society and by IEEE Software Magazine, online at computer.org/software.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Software Engineering Radio. Our guest today is Praveen Gujjar. Praveen is Director of Product at LinkedIn. He has over a decade of experience building digital advertising products using AI and ML. Today, the topic of our discussion with Praveen is in how GenAI has impacted the development of digital ad tech platforms. Welcome to this show, Praveen. It's great to have you here. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your bio before we jump right in?
Yeah, thank you, Kanchan. Thanks for the opportunity. This is exciting to be here. Yeah, nothing more to add, right? Let's get started.
I'd just like to point folks to two episodes that we have done in the past. One of them, episode 493, Ram Siri Hirsha on vectors and machine learning. It's a very related topic. The other one would be 610, Philip Carter on observability for large language model, where some basics of GenAI were covered. So Praveen, what is a digital ad tech platform?
Great. That's a great question to start with. Let's take a step back and understand what the world was before digital advertising and then talk about what digital advertising is and what promises it made and what solutions it offers. So before digital advertising or advent of internet, traditionally advertisement was done on what we call like traditional media. Is it print media or linear television, right? Print media may be on magazine or paper, or linear television is basically your television networks in the past. So the three challenges that imposed, number one was a reach to personalized audience was very difficult on these mediums. That means you're basically advertising for pretty much most of the population and selecting specific audience per your interest was largely difficult. Number two, basically specific content or customizing content for your audience was even more challenging. Well, you could have different content in different newspapers, but it was still a lot more challenging than what compares today. Third, basically, and probably one of the critical piece was understanding the return on investment of the ad spend was extremely difficult, especially when you do brand campaigns or conversion campaigns, it was very difficult. So with digital advertising, it promised to address these three gaps so that you can actually reach to more granular and more custom audiences, solving the first problem. Second, you can have more customized content to the audience when they are active in the right channel as well. And last but not the least, have more fine-grained attribution models or measurement models that basically gave you a lot more understanding about how your ad spend is performing and what is the return on investment on it. So Digital Advertise basically is a centralized platform that basically manages ads to who it is served, when it is served, what content is served, and what channel it is served in. And finally, measuring the performance of your ad spend and then optimizing continuously to ensure that return on investment keeps increasing as well. In summary, digital advertising is a platform that manages all these aspects.
Can you describe what was the state of the art, let's say 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think we talked about like 20 plus years back, how traditional media played a critical role in advertisement. With digital advertising in the last 5-10 years, a lot of the audience reach, when do you reach the audience, and attribution models or measurement models were rule-based. That means you had less control on what kind of an audience you could actually reach, mainly demographic information like age and gender, for example. And the number of platforms, basically, you could reach was also limited. And as users adapted to multiple platforms or multiple devices, digital advertising had to adapt as well. And last but not the least, we had simple measurement models that basically gave you a decent understanding about what your ROI was. But with latest changes in AI and LLMs, all of these things are changing.
What does the current ecosystem look like and who are the key players?
Yeah, so if you see digital advertising, it's very complicated space. Let's just break it down who the key players are and what kind of a platforms play a role here. Number one is advertisers. These are big brands, for example, or agencies who advertise on behalf of the brands. They are the people who buy the advertisement that basically gets served on different surfaces or channels in this case. The second one is publishers. These are the businesses that provide the surfaces for digital advertising that basically also includes web pages or apps or any other such supply that provides digital advertising spaces. And connecting the buyer and the publisher here are multiple ad platforms. Let's just go through two or three such ad platforms. Number one basically is what we call audience exchanges. These are real-time buying platforms that enable the buyers and sellers, in this case, the advertisers and the publishers, to provide their supply in the market and also enable advertisers to buy the digital advertising in a programmatic manner. The second one is the audience network, where basically, if you're an advertiser, you can use programmatic access to buy on different partners' publications that are available. So one of the examples can be Google's own audience network, where you can actually buy ads on Google and then it gets surfaced in various partner publications that they partner with. And among all these things are various other platforms as well. Let's just talk about two things, which is cater to the needs of demand and supply. So the demand side, there are demand side platforms that enable advertisers to programmatically buy ads on different ad exchanges as well as audience networks as well. So it's really truly a marketplace kind of a concept as well. On the flip side, the supply side platforms enables the publishers to sell their inventory so that multiple advertisers can actually bid on that inventory as well. So it's quite a complicated world with different platforms as well. But last, let's just focus on one thing, which is to keep this advertising business with a trust and safe manner as well. There are verification companies that play a very critical role. So for example, there will be creative validators who will verify whether the ad that's being displayed on the publisher caters to the need of the policy that the publisher has supplied, or is it that of a good quality to be shown on the publisher network itself. So these are all different kind of a partner platforms that play a very critical role when it comes to orchestrating an advertisement.
Okay, so our topic today is how GenAI has impacted these platforms, the development of these platforms, the teams that comprise these platforms as well. But why don't we start with just explaining what GenAI is?
Yeah, I think in a very simple term, GenAI is a sort of AI stream that basically specializes in generating content, be it text, audio, video, or a multimodal content, which has a combination of all of these things. Why is it important in digital advertising? Is it because when a user consumes a content piece, it's basically typically in the format of text, video, or audio, or combination of all of these. So making sure that you generate the right content to the right audience at the right time can be a lot more scalably built and dynamically built using GenAI. And GenAI is not just about generation as well. The underlying models, the LLMs that power a lot of the GenAI, can also be used in multiple purposes in digital advertising. The sheer ability of them understanding patterns within the data and the transformer architecture, both on the encoder-decoder side and decoder-only models, can be of immense help to understand context, understand audience signals, and then really serve the most relevant and customized ad to the right audience at the right time. That's really where GenAI, both from a generation perspective and also from a LLM perspective, is adding value in digital advertising.
You mentioned the transformer architecture. Why has that been so key?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's understand what a transformer and what self-attention really means and how that basically has transformed the segmentation pieces as well as content generation piece. There is two things that it really, really helped. Let's understand what a transformer model is, right? I think the biggest change has been the self-attention that basically gives you the contextual awareness of a particular ad copy or a web page that enables you to deliver contextual ad to the right audience as well. The second, the large language models that basically powers are built on transformers are able to understand and recognize patterns in the data much better than what it used to be because of parallel processing, lower compute capacity when compared to others, and also amount of data that they have been trained on as well. So transformers, one thing that it really excels at is pre-trained models. These are pre-trained models that can be fine-tuned to a specific industry as well and can be augmented with more data as well. That's where like the RAG, the RAG models basically play a critical role. So again, pre-trained models can be fine-tuned and can be augmented as well. And in combination with the parallel processing or the efficient use of compute capacity, they're able to better segment audiences and also better able to generate content that are more relevant to audiences. So at the heart of it, again, to summarize, self-attention, parallel processing of the data, encoder and decoder model that basically enables them to parallelly process and generate contextually aware data, and pre-training and fine-tuning of the through data enables them to be more efficient in segmenting the audiences as well as reaching out the right, as well as creating the content for the audience.
Can you use an example to illustrate this?
Let's talk about, take an example and then talk about how the transformer architecture has really revolutionized as well. So let's use this use case throughout our discussion. So you are a small tennis shop based out of San Francisco, and you're trying to basically increase foot traffic to your store. So there is more rackets and tennis courts that are being sold. So if that is basically the SMB that you are, and that's your main objective, then how can advertising actually help? So with that context, let's talk about how transformer architecture basically helps power some of the capabilities. So the crux of what transformer architecture is self-attention, right? It's basically the AI models understanding in a text or in a video format, like what is the most relevant content and how they are related to each other, right? Giving different weights and relationship to the different content that are present in the sentence, for example. Why is it so important in digital advertising spaces? It provides you the context to basically for the AI models to understand the content that it's serving the ad against, and also to generate human readable content that is more relevant to the human eye as well. That's the main use case of transformer models within the digital advertising space. So for example, if this tennis shop wants to run ads and tailor message for different audiences of different age and demographic information, what transformer architecture enables you to basically generate those ad copy to different segments with fully context of the brand identity as well that is available. And that's the key thing that transformer architecture has enabled in the digital advertising space.
Thanks, Praveen, for that intro. Let's get back a little bit later, drilling into the technologies that impact the platform. You brought up the example of a small business owner, a tennis shop. Can we describe the persona of the users within this tennis shop that will interact with the platform?
Yeah, let me first start with the SMB and then maybe expand a little bit, because there are so many different players that play a role. So typically in a tennis shop, let's assume that you are a sole proprietary owner who is running this tennis shop. So you are a marketer, you are the owner of the shop, you run the shop and do everything, and you have less time, less understanding about how digital advertising actually works. So you need more sophisticated solutions that simplifies the job for you. So you are the marketer in this case as well. But typically, if you enlarge this use case to larger brands or media agencies, you will have multiple personas in it. It can be a marketer who is basically running ad campaigns on a day-to-day basis. It can be creative directors who are primarily responsible for generating creatives or content that are used in the digital advertising space or that are used in the ad campaigns. It can also be the whole marketing directors who are end-to-end responsible for managing multiple ad campaigns and eventually responsible for understanding the return on investment as well, and basically are responsible to generate higher return on investment. To help them, there will be analysts also who basically do a lot more data work that are necessary to basically understand campaign setups, campaign optimization, as well as understand the return on investment as well, so that they can report up to these executives as well. So there are multiple personas that play a role. And not to make this more complex, there are agencies that are middle person in this as well, where if you are basically a bigger brand like Coca-Cola, you typically have agencies, so you have employed agencies to do the digital marketing work. They also run campaigns on different objectives on behalf of the brands. So these are all some of the key players in this particular space.
Thanks for that, Ravi. Now, in terms of the tennis shop, it's really a small business. You have multiple roles played by maybe the same person, the marketer, the creative director. Assuming that, can we talk through a day in the life of somebody who's interacting with the platform? And you mentioned campaigns. What exactly is a campaign?
Yeah, let's start with the unit campaign first, and then maybe we can expand on your question. So in a very simple term, campaign basically is that you ad unit that you're actually using to reach to your audience as well. It can be a set of combination between the definition of the target audience that you actually have and the creative or the content that you're using to reach to this audience is basically bundled in a campaign. So you serve these ad content to your users. Then coming back to your question on what does a marketer, a creative director, or a one person all typically does or a day in a job looks like, right? Typically, let's divide into two set of things. One is campaign planning and second one is campaign execution. So what do we mean by campaign planning, right? So in this case, the marketer of this particular shop has to have a clear objective on what he or she wants to achieve. Do they want to basically generate awareness for the shop, increase footsteps to the shop, or want to do digital conversion from the shop as well? That means basically people can visit the website and buy on the website also. There are multiple objectives as a marketer we may want to achieve. So all those things basically goes into campaign planning. In addition to that, who are my target audience, understanding of it, doing research on that, and what kind of a budget I have in what to allocate to different objectives, and what kind of content I can actually create to reach out to these specific audience. All those things basically goes into campaign planning. The second part of the job basically is campaign management, where you are incorporating all the planning that you have done into a marketing campaign, which basically means you are now setting up an audience who you want to reach. You are using the creatives to serve to those audiences, and you are continuously measuring the performance of your ad campaigns or marketing campaigns, and then optimizing or fine-tuning your campaign operations so that you continue to achieve your objective better and better. And of course, this is easy to say than done, because this is a complex domain, needs a thorough understanding about like how to optimize different levers that are present to get the maximum return on investment. This is really where AI automation may be very, very helpful for specifically for these SMBs. Imagine a platform, an ad platform, who can automate using AI the complete operations and simplify it to a single click operation, can deliver a lot more value to these SMB owners and simplify the job of them so that they can focus on their core job, which is running the shop in this case, and engaging with the customers. So that's really where AI comes into picture, to simplify all these operations and ensure that you receive the maximum ROI for the ad spend that you actually do.
As the marketing director of the small business, how do I really specify to the platform who my intended audience is?
Typically, as I said, in the planning phase, you need to basically understand who your target audience are. It starts with an objective. Then you determine, let's just simplify this. I want to reach to audience of 20 to 40 years who live in San Francisco Bay Area, because I don't have a website to sell my goods on, so I need to convert foot traffic to my shop. So if that is the criteria, then you basically use, the platform provides different levers. It can be reaching based on the age, based on the occupation, based on buyer intent, for example. All those levers can be used to say these are the type of audience are most likely to come to my shop. And those are the audience I have to reach to generate awareness and also create foot traffic to my shop as well. So the platform provides those capabilities in the tools to make sure that you select the desired audience you actually want. When now, as a shop owner, you may not know these audiences. And this is where the AI-powered predictive audiences come into picture, which basically are AI models that basically understands typical behavior of audiences for your business, what their buyer intention is, what kind of signals they do rest of the internet, and then basically even use your own specific sales data to recommend what type of audience you should basically reach as well. That's what we call predictive audiences. And AI is basically simplifies that planning and reaching for a job as well for these SMB owners.
That's a good segue. So in the next several minutes, I'd like to now drill down into what the platform needs to do. And you mentioned it starts with the model. So can you explain what is the approach of selecting different model architectures for the platform?
If you're an ad platform, I think you're trying to basically optimize across multiple things as well. One is, what is the context or what is the objective that the advertiser actually want to reach? And based on that object, you want to basically make sure that the right models are serving those platforms as well. That's one. And what kind of a data that we basically have? So when it comes to an ad campaign, if you're near a platform, you're thinking about model selections, right? It's the platform data that is also important, which is the first party data. There is also importance of third party data. That basically means data sourced from third party sources as well. But also what is really important is the brand specific data as well. So what do you mean by brand specific data, right? So maybe this is not that appropriate for the SMB space or the small business that any shop here. But if you're basically Coca-Cola's of the world, you have run campaigns for multiple years with the platform and you have very specific data about what are their specific audiences, what kind of a conversion they basically do. And these data tells you a lot more about what kind of performance we can deliver on this. So if you're basically selecting a model, and the model selection basically depends upon this data as well, then the job at hand for the platform as well. So you want to basically optimize for a couple of things, right? One, the performance of the models. That includes basically accuracy and latency. than the computational resources that are actually required from the model perspective as well, because you don't want to use large language models or models that take significant compute capacity for smaller jobs, like, for example, copy generation. So job-specific tasks that are basically needed as well. And there is a significant ask of transparency to the users as well. That's play a critical role in selection of what type of models are necessary, because certain aspects need more transparency to the user, like, for example, copy generation or return on investment measurement or measurement piece, whereas ad serving piece may not need the same level of transparency for the user. So all these factors go into the analysis of what different models basically power different stages of campaign management from a platform perspective.
One of the things that I got from what you said was that in the case of audience segmentation, you probably need a large model, but for copy generation, you need a small model, or you can live with a small model that's more performant.
Yeah, that's a trade-off that the platform can definitely do. And these smaller models basically are trained on like a much fewer parameters than a large language model. They take less computational capacity. From a performance perspective, you're generating ad copies. They are very similar from a performance perspective. So that's a very valid trade-off for this particular use case.
Do you have an example of a small language model for this space?
Yeah, I think Microsoft Y3 basically can be a really good example for search. In fact, like, we were writing a paper on this and how SLMs versus LLMs can do better in terms of ad copy generation and can do so on device. We were able to run some of these open source models on our laptops to basically generate ad copies. So what we did basically is the data set that was used was Amazon's product catalog. And with a little bit of a prompt engineering, we were able to run these models on laptop and generate more very relevant ad copy content that compares to what an LLM would actually do that were run on AWS, for example. So yeah, there are multiple such SLMs that are also open sourced that can actually help you achieve some of these objectives.
Coming back to some other concepts you had mentioned earlier, one was the encoder and decoder. Can you explain that? Relevance of that in this context?
Sure. I think what makes a transformer model unique compared to RNNs, the traditional RNNs that we basically used to use, is the encoder and decoder architecture, right? The encoder basically helps you to understand and map the relationship of certain words from a contextual manner. So for example, if you are actually feeding a web page, the encoder model goes through the web page and generates a vector mapping of all the words listed in the web pages and contextually ties them together as well. And if you're asking the LLMs to basically generate an ad copy from the web page, then the decoder plays a role, which basically then generates the necessary ad copy based on the contextual mapping that the encoder actually has done. And in a digital advertising space, this is even more important because we talked about the latency, right? You can do these things more parallelly so that you can still maintain lesser latency and be within the tolerance needed to serve an ad platform on a publisher network or an owned and operated network.
You introduced RNN, or recurrent neural network. I'd like to provide this link to our listeners on an episode we have done earlier on neural networks. This is Software Engineering Radio, episode 594. Sean Moriarty on deep learning with Elixir and Exxon. Back to the encoder-decoder architecture, Praveen, can you take an example of our SMB and contrast these models and explain which one is used where?
Yeah, definitely. I think let's take the same example of the tennis shop and try to see how encoder-decoder model or decoder-only model can be helpful. So you basically, if you're a tennis shop, your campaigns are maybe set up in two different ways. Number one, basically for audiences from 20 to 30 years old, we have copy generation. And from 30 to 40 and 40 to 50, you have certain way of copy generation. Let's just say that is the use case. And to make it a little bit more complicated, now you have English-speaking population and Spanish-speaking population. You want to generate content for both of the needs as well. So this is where the encoder-decoder model and decoder-only model can be a lot more useful. So you have only one content that you're uploading to the ads platform. And using that content, all these different variants are generated. So to generate English-only models for different age demographic, decoder model is enough because these are basically generated through the prompts that are basically providing and the initial copy version that is being generated, right? Whereas you want to use the same initial copy version to translate that into Spanish version as well, be contextually aware, human readable. That's where encoder and decoder architecture comes into picture. So a platform using different models can actually serve all these multiple variants that the SMB owner wants to do as well.
What about the data that the models are trained on? They certainly have to serve a very large variety of advertisers.
Yeah, so basically, these models get trained pretty much every few hours in a day from vast amount of data that is basically the first party and third party data that the platform actually owns. And when you have to do specialized operations, for example, dynamically generate a content for an advertiser, then you can also rely on a retrieval augmented generation mechanism as well to generate brand specific copies as well. But you can imagine the data that is basically used for this, right? Number one is any kind of a product analytic that happens. If you're a social media platform that also supports advertisement, any engagement that happens on your platform, that may be clicks, likes, or any kind of a shout out that actually happens, that basically tells you user behavior. That's very critical data that goes in. User intent, that means basically you have to visualize a user journey in a funnel of a buyer funnel, basically. That means it's just simplifying three stages. First, you are trying to be aware of what you want to purchase. Then you know, basically that means you are more in the awareness stage. Second, basically you have narrowed down on parameter on certain key things and narrowed down on the products that you want to purchase as well. Then you are more deeper in research as well. And third one is basically conversion. So a lot of these engagement data from both first party, third party, and even brand specific conversion data gives signals to the platform on where the user is in the buyer funnel. And this is completely different for a B2C brand versus a B2B brand, because the users and their buyer funnel are completely different. So that's a very critical data as well. And finally, basically the ad, the placement of the ad, where the ad is actually served, the context in that and how user is engaging with that particular content is also very critical. And these are all the data that basically is used by the ads platform to power various capabilities, including audience segmentation, content generation, ad serving, and measurement as well. Before I forget, I think a lot of basically what the trend also is the brands basically providing a lot of their sales data as well to further understand conversion and better understand the return on investment that they are actually doing as well. That basically helps even the ads platform to provide a lot more granular information, both online conversion and offline conversion. So in this case, what we mean by offline conversion, right? Someone engaged with this tennis shop's ad, but went to the store and bought the tennis racket there. And that conversion that they are using a QuickBooks or anything or a CRM solution that plugged into the ads platform provides additional signal for measurement as well.
So my takeaway from that was that there's a lot of data that is owned by the ad platforms, but also as a business owner, I let the ad platforms then accumulate signals from my website.
Website as well as like your CRM or sales data or conversion data as well, right? The more data these SMBs or any other brands can provide, the better AI models can be trained on for specific needs. Specifically, your conversion data, right? Like either in CRM or any other data can be used in two purposes. One, in measurement to better understand the ROI. The second piece is optimization. Now you understand who are converting, then you can actually optimize and your predictive audiences can be even more better than before. Your ad serving can be better as well, because now you understand what type of conversion is happening on your platform.
Is there a privacy concern there with me as a business owner sharing all this with the platform?
That's a very good question. One of the biggest blockers for any SMB or a brand is the privacy or compliance reasons, right? The bigger brands you are, you have to go through various compliance checks to ensure that the right data is shared, right level of masking is done or anonymity is done on the data. So the good thing basically here, and this is probably a very common misunderstanding, the ad platforms don't really need specific user data or a PII, what we call, right? Personally identified information. It needs aggregated data and it's aggregated conversion data. That's basically what I realize a lot more on. Working with the brands, making sure that either through solutions like CAPI, which is basically conversion APIs, or injecting CRM data directly into the clean room of the ads platforms is a very viable way to be both compliant and also ensure that you provide the necessary information for the platform to not only measure the effectiveness of your ad campaign, but also optimize for them for future needs.
You mentioned an acronym CAPI. Can you explain what that?
CAPI is a conversion API. It's basically server-to-server signal that is being sent. So for example, if a conversion actually happened, in this case, the tennis shop's website basically sends conversion signal directly to the ad platform.
In terms of the model, and this extra signals that are sent over to the model, does that fall under fine-tuning? Or is that a completely different way to think about fine-tuning?
It definitely is part of fine-tuning as well, because the more conversion data basically has, the measurement model that can be attribution models get additional signals for you to ensure that can provide more information. The fine-tuning also is parameter tuning, right? It's basically narrowing down the parameters to the most relevant parameter that are necessary, pruning of the parameters and also a piece of it as well. And the second piece of fine-tuning also is relying on reinforcement learning, either human or AI-based, to ensure that you weigh the parameters clearly as well. So yeah, fine-tuning typically refers to that, but you can call this as fine-tuning because it enables your models to be a lot more accurate.
And here, reinforcement learning is by the experience that the advertiser now has in the ad campaign on how people react to.
Yeah, so I think the platforms are capable to basically get a reinforcement learning through the advertiser directly as well, based on the specific questionnaire, for example, as well. We can also get feedback directly from the user. We run market research surveys that provides very valuable signals from there. And also there are AI models that basically does reinforcement learning in this case to ensure that you continue to learn and improve the performance of the model.
You also had talked about RAG or retrieval augmented generation. Can you contrast that with fine-tuning?
So what does a RAG, retrieval augmented generation, is, right? So let's take basically the case of the tennis shop. An ads platform may understand an aggregated information about tennis shops across the globe or across the United States. But what does your brand specializes in? What is your brand identity is something that the AIs may not be specifically be aware of as well. The retrieval augmented generation is a technique where you basically infuse this brand specific data to your AI models at the time of decision making to ensure that you actually augment the capability of the AI models to produce more brand relevant data or brand relevant content. That means basically if you have two tennis shops, one is specializes in tennis shop only and takes pride in it, on tennis gear only, and the second one basically specializes in tennis gear and pickleball, you want to make sure that the shop that you're advertising with is takes pride in only tennis only shop, to make sure that the ad copy generated is very specific to that. I know it just sounds strange. I think tennis lovers will understand the difference between pickleball and tennis. But yeah, I think that level of brand specificity is what RAG really enables, right? Whereas fine-tuning basically, or reinforcement learning, is basically an ability for models to continuously learn and improve on top of it. It may or may not have any information about the brand-specific information. And this fine-tuning can be done at the aggregated level. That means that all the tennis shops together or the sports shops together as well. And that's where these are different in nature.
So how is RAG set up? Just continuing on an example, what do I need as a tennis shop owner to provide to the platform so that it can leverage my specific data at runtime and not make sure that the model is changed in any form or fashion?
Yeah, let's first talk about three critical components in RAG and then tie it up to the tennis shop as well. So what are three things that are very necessary, right? One is basically a knowledge base of the brand. These can be graphs that are built to store this, or vector spaces as well that basically analyzes it. And these are typically derived from web pages, any other brand-specific information that the tennis shop can actually provide as well. The second one basically is the retrieval models, how specific and what specific entity can you actually retrieve to augment the data to the main model. That's the second piece that is necessary. And then basically any kind of a reinforcement learning that you can actually run. That's the third piece of it. But the main two pieces are basically the knowledge base as well as the retrieval model. So if you're basically a tennis shop, I think to really help brand identity, there are two things that you can do really well. One is basically provide all your assets that you actually have. That may be web pages, that may be product catalogs, brochures, or any other thing, any kind of a sales that you basically run or conversion that you happens on your platform. Those are very specific to your brand, very specific to your own identity, that basically will help quite a bit. This is not something that you have to explicitly do, because if you have history of campaigns that you have actually run, the platforms will actually have access to those campaigns. And from that, they can actually build better repository for your brand and also ensure that the retrieval model can actually fetch the right data to augment for the main models as well.
Just confirming that this is something that the ad platform will maintain per client.
So the augmentation is per client, let's just say, right? Basically, the RAG model is a generic framework. When a brand-specific ad is in question, then the retrieval is basically very brand-specific.
So now let's get back to how exactly the technologies behind GenAI have made a lot of this better. So you did talk about vectors in RAG. Can you give an example or maybe explain more what vector embeddings are? And I did point folks earlier to an episode that we have done on that in the past, but a little bit of recap of that would be useful.
What are vector embeddings, right? So let's start. There are three concepts that may be important here. One is embeddings, one is vectors, and then basically our vector search and then vector space, right? So let's take the same tennis shop example and try to combine everything together. So embeddings in a very simple term basically is the content that you actually have provided to the platform, right? Either a web thing is basically converted into vectors. It's basically a number game. And they are converted in such a way that basically you understand the context and the relevancy or correlation between the contents as well. So that's where the context awareness really comes into picture. The second basically is vector search as well, right? So this is happens in a vector space. So let's take an example. Vector space is like a multidimensional vector space where all the assets and the ad units and everything is basically converted into embeddings and basically stored. And the vector search is basically identifying the right content, right, the ad unit to retrieve when a particular page is basically shown to a user to surface ads on. So let's take an example. So you are a tennis shop and you're basically running ads on what you generally call audience network, right? Audience network can be a publisher network, which is if you are like Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn or Google, you have ties with the publishing partners like CNN.com, Fox News, Tennis Warehouse, and many other publishers who sell their ad space for these platforms. So if a user basically is, let's just say for simplicity here, browsing on CNN.com and Praveen is an avid tennis player. So what happens here? So number one, like these ad platforms could have two types. Like they would have already had embeddings for CNN.com various pages. They routinely scan some of these publisher networks, convert them into embeddings and basically build their vector space based out of it. So that's basically the web page content that is stored as embedded in the vector space. Then you have this tennis shop, the San Francisco-based tennis shop. They have multiple ad units or campaign contents, right, that are also converted into embeddings and this are in the same space. Now, the magic of basically collating these things together happens, right? When I visit the tennis shop, my behavior, my buyer intention is basically understood. Then from the vector embeddings in the vector space, you now know what is the content of the website that you are visiting as well. And then the ad platform then makes a selection of what is the right ad you need to pick for this particular content for this particular user to serve it on it. That's how the embeddings, vector search, and vector space basically combine together to serve the most relevant content to the user here. That's me when I'm visiting CNN.com.
So this is you when you visited CNN.com. We understand how vector search, vector embeddings come into the picture. What is the magic that happens when this tennis shop really wants to create an audience segment? And how are you chosen in there? How does that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I like the way you used to ask the questions on what used to happen 5 years back and what has happened today, right? Let's take the same lens and try to walk through this. Like 5-10 years back, there were mostly rule-based segmentation, right? So you used to basically identify what is the key demographics that you want to reach, maybe age, gender, location, so many different things. But now, basically, the AI models powered predictive audiences is a lot more popular. So what do they basically understand? They definitely take demographic information. In addition to that, firmographic information, that's basically your professional data that can be useful, your behavioral data, what kind of a content you engage with, what are the kinds of contents that you don't engage with also. That is important as well. What is your intent? Like at this time, what is your main objective basically, right? That's the signal that you actually get as well. And all these things basically get fed into the predictive audience models to ensure that you create the right audience that have higher propensity of engaging and converting with your ad. And that's what basically predictive audiences is. So this is in the old time, basically, there used to be lookalike audiences. So what do we mean by that, right? If the most of your audience are 20 to 30 year old in San Francisco or engaging with that, lookalike audience would expand that audience base a little bit. But predictive audiences is a lot different than that, right? It's not just an expansion of an audience, but really a deeper understanding about who, what kind of an audience have higher propensity of conversion or meeting your objective. That's the key piece that predictive audiences basically solve for.
And transformers have helped with that. You mentioned the attention mechanism. Is that for predictive audience selection or for generation of content.
So I think the transformer architecture play a lot more role on the generation of the content. But basically, like if you're using an encoding and decoding models, right, the context awareness really comes from the encoding model and the generation comes from the decoding model. And they actually help to generate the right content for the audiences. Now, you from the encoder model, you understand what a web page they are actually engaged with, what is the context of the thing, web page, and who the audience basically is. And then the decoder model plays a role of generating the human readable content, whether it's text, video, or audio format.
Thanks, Praveen. So we covered content generation, where you mentioned that the transformer architecture and specifically the attention mechanism are key. I'll put a link and show notes to an explanatory video for the attention mechanism that you pointed me to. We also then talked about predictive audience targeting, where the extensive data sets that the model is trained on is what enables this capability. And then lastly, you started to talk about content, which is not just text, but audio and video. Let's now talk about some of the multimodal capabilities and how they relate to the model and model selection, because the content that is generated is not just text, it's images and videos, etc. So how has that helped?
Yeah, I think multimodal model clearly is the future from a perspective that it provides a lot more personalized content, which is higher performing content as well. So differentiate, to take a step back, like typically a lot of the model used to turn on different text, speech, and video data, right? Audio, video, and this thing. And then they used to combine together again to make sure that the model understands from a multimodality perspective as well. But like, as you can imagine, there's a lot more processing that you have to do from a having different data sets trained and then basically combining them together as well. The multimodal model approach really is training with the native content that has all three embedded in it, right? Like it's basically video with transcription that has audio, text, as well as video as well. So training the models from in a native way from a multimodal content itself, they tend to perform much higher from a performance perspective as well. And because of higher performance, basically, they can actually generate content that are multimodal in nature also, that are a lot more native to the, that were a lot more performant to the end user as well.
One thing does come to mind, especially maybe for ad serving, because now this is real-time ad serving, it is taking a lot more into account of your current behavior as you're interacting with the website. Can you talk a little bit about performance? How has performance maybe improved, or what kind of role that plays in making sure that the ad content is generated to your current behavior and interactions?
Yeah, so I think as I talked about, these are models basically get retrained pretty much every few hours, right? And if it's basically your ad serving models, those are basically getting trained, or your predictive audience models, those are basically getting retrained every few hours as well. And while the campaign is basically live, your audience definition may be changing because of predictive audiences. So for example, there are signals that I actually have already bought a racket, that I'm out of the market for racket purchase, and I won't be available in your audience segmentation that is defined through predictive audiences. So like the signals that basically are live are as the models are retrained or fine-tuned as a long basis as well, these signals basically get accounted for, and your predictive audience is very dynamic from that perspective.
Praveen, I'd like to now get into some of the team composition and how that has changed with Gen AI. Is there anything else you'd like to cover in the current topic of capabilities before we go there?
No, I think from a technical capabilities, model capabilities, I think we cover really a good breadth. Definitely, we can talk about how team dynamics or organization structure play a very critical role to execute on this.
Now let's talk about the teams. How has that changed? What does a cross-functional product team look like today in building these platforms?
Let's take the same example of 5 years back, how we used to work and how we are working now, or how what direction we are moving in. So typically, you might have seen in many organizations as well, there used to be a separate AI team, separate data science team, and there used to be product teams, which is typically made of product managers, back-end, front-end engineers, and full-stack engineers. That was the typical composition of many organizations as well. We used to invest quite a bit in AI capabilities. The AI team centrally used to optimize for different businesses, if you specifically have different businesses within a large organization. What we realized from that model is there is constant prioritization is a big challenge in this kind of a working environment, because specifically, take example, LinkedIn has multiple business units and they have different needs. So managing across all these things are very difficult for a centralized AI team. So that's a challenge. So the second challenge also basically is the AI teams are not so very closer to the product by itself sometimes, right? And that basically may be a challenge. Or they are brought in much later in the product development lifecycle without the full context or understanding about the product. They may not be able to come up with the right solution to power the products as well. These are all the challenges that basically used to occur in this kind of a distributed model. So the new model that many of the organizations are working towards are already on right now is a more embedded model within the product teams itself. So now the product team no longer has only the back and front end engineers and the product managers. They have the AI engineers and data scientists working all together towards a single OKR or objective and key results, right? They have single goals. They are involved in the product development right from day one. So they are a part of the life cycle fully. They understand and they are specialized in this particular product areas as well. This model helps to solve a lot of those problems, and where really like the AI engineers can actually build solutions that are a lot more tailor-made for the product capabilities. There is a second benefit also from this, right? Now you're actually increasing AI proficiency, overall AI proficiency within the team. So you're basically cross-educating the what traditional back and front end engineers were on AI capabilities as well. And they are not more AI proficient. And this really helps to basically build like an AI first model or AI first products. Those are some of the key organization changes that we are actually seeing to really move towards the direction of AI integrated or AI first products to really completely use the power of AI to add value to the products.
Can you comment on the overlap between an AI engineer and a data scientist?
Sure. Let's take, maybe there are three categories that typically we see in the organization. So there are data engineers or business analysts. They basically may be specialized in building data pipelines, building metrics, dashboards, and other capabilities. Those are one type of engineers who work on data. The second one basically are like a product analyst, for lack of a better term. These are data scientists, also called data scientists, who really work with the product teams to understand opportunities in the product. So for example, if you are in the onboarding flow of any kind of a product, there may be a lot of leakage that is actually happening. So identify the points of leakage and identify and come up with solutions on how to prevent that leakage to make sure that onboarding has higher conversion. All this work basically is done through data, these kind of a second tier data scientists, like who basically work on these capabilities. And last but not the least are the engineers who basically build AI models or basically take the foundational AI models and convert them or fine-tune them for their own specific needs, or even build some AI model that are serving custom purposes as well. So these are broadly three categories. One, basically data pipeline and analytics. And second one is basically product understanding, product analytics, product recommendations. Third one basically is model development and model fine-tuning.
You did also mention that more and more the expectation is that the full stack engineers are also understanding and cognizant of what these AI engineering tasks are too.
Yeah, 100%. I think what organizations are looking is the product team that is a lot more AI proficient. Even if they basically may not be building AI models, they are proficient in a way to basically train an AI model, do prompt engineering if needed as well, and use the AI model in the right way. All those capabilities are something that is desired. And also, if you are basically an engineer, AI is here to stay. It is in your best interest, in your professional best interest to be AI proficient as well. Learn the inner workings of AI and enable the team to be successful. I think from that perspective as well, it's a very critical piece for what traditionally like the full stack engineers used to be.
Thanks, Praveen. Starting to wrap up now, you talked a lot about how Gen AI has impacted the platform. How about how has digital ad tech adapted to have ads show up in the right form or fashion now that we have more and more conversational AI systems like ChatGPT and voice-based platform in addition to search-based?
Yeah, that's a great question. I recently wrote an article about this. Let's take an example here also. And this time we are moving away from the tennis shop example. I think if anything, the short-form videos are hugely popular now. It can be TikTok Reels, Instagram, TikTok. I don't know what it's called even on TikTok, Instagram Reels, for example, a short-term video, right? They are designed in a way to have shorter attention span for the user, right? 60 seconds at max, basically. So this introduces a lot of challenges for advertisers to advertise on this platform. But users are mostly engaged on these kind of a medium right now. So how do you reach to these medium that are basically primarily designed for lesser attention span? Whereas if you're an advertiser, you want the user to pay attention to your ad, engage with your ad, and convert with your ad as well, right? And these kinds of a thing is very important for a marketer. And from that perspective, generative AI is really useful. How can a marketer or an advertiser really grab attention of a user in a short form video format is through interactive ads or conversation ads, right? Basically giving an option for the user to choose a different kind of a product they want to basically see, giving a survey questions or ask a question on how to basically kind of provide a game or anything that within the ads itself that they can engage with as well. So that's one of the way that actually they can engage with the user in the short video format medium. And that's where generative AI can be really useful, because now depending upon the user inputs, the ads can actually react with different messages that actually follows up. And when you want to do this at scale, generative AI can be the third engine that can actually power different variants of messages depending upon the user's choices.
I'll put in a link to the article you mentioned in the show notes, along with a couple of the other pointers you had, for example, on Microsoft Phi 3. Would you have a similar idea about ads that show up, or the form factor in which they show up, when I'm just chatting with ChatGPT? What do I expect to see there?
Yeah. So if you're basically perplexity, right, which is basically literally like a question in engine, their monetization model in the future can be ads model. So if you are basically now asking about how does a tennis racket work, or what is the balance in the tennis racket, then they can basically start showing ads, and that ad can be more conversational as well, trying to basically help the user narrow down on what is the specific racket that can be a lot more useful for his or her own playing style, right? I think that's really where the conversational AI ads can be super useful.
This was a great conversation, Praveen. Where can people contact you?
I think LinkedIn would be the best place to reach out to me. So I'm happy to connect there and also answer any questions further.
Thank you so much for coming on, and it's a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for having me, Kanchan. It was great talking to you here.
Thanks for listening to SE Radio, an educational program brought to you by IEEE Software Magazine. For more about the podcast, including other episodes, visit our website at se-radio.net. To provide feedback, you can comment on each episode on the website, or reach us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or through our Slack channel at seradio.slack.com. You can also email us at team@se-radio.net. This and all other episodes of SE Radio is licensed under Creative Commons License 2.5. Thanks for listening.